As human beings, our first literary experiences are with fairy tales. The stories we hear and tell at bedtime are drawn from a rich and varied tradition that stretches back through generations. Welcome again to Trinity Rep Radio Theater, produced by Trinity Repertory Company and WRNI. Trinity Rep Radio Theater is a monthly exploration of dramatic literature featuring members of Trinity Rep's resident acting company. Today's program features five fairy tales. I'm your host, Bob C., and joining me is Kurt Columbus, Trinity Rep's artistic director.
Always a pleasure, Bob.
And three members of Trinity's resident acting company, Stephen Berenson, Angela Brazil, and Phyllis Kay. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi, Bob.
Kurt, fairy tales are something new for Trinity Rep Radio Theater.
Yeah, they are, Bob, but we've been planning to do a fairy tale show for a long time. We think it's only natural because the work that we do at Trinity Rep is all about the power of storytelling, and, well, fairy tales are at the heart of that. And I want to read a quote, actually, here at the very beginning. It's from the introduction of Angela Carter's collection. It's called The Old Wives Fairy Tale Book, and Janice Duclos, who's one of our producers, found this. Okay, so here's the quote. You'll find very few actual fairies in these stories. Talking beasts, yes. Supernatural beings and sequences of events that bend somewhat the laws of physics. We use the term, quote, fairy tale, loosely to describe the great mass of infinitely various narrative that was, once upon a time, and still is, sometimes, passed on by word of mouth, stories that can be remade again and again by every person who tells them. The perennially refreshed entertainment of the poor. For most of human history, literature has been narrated, not written. Heard, not read. Fairy tales are the most vital connection we have with the imagination of the ordinary men and women whose labor created our world. And I think that's a pretty great description of fairy tales broadly.
It is. And we've all had experiences, of course, with fairy tales. Why don't we talk a little bit about that? First, Phyllis, what fairy tales do you remember?
Well, I was lucky enough to be read bedtime stories. I do remember that. My mom would read bedtime stories, and my dad was a book dealer, so the books that she was provided with were spectacular. My most wonderful memory, I guess, is of the books themselves, which were those beautiful gilt-paged books with the rice paper over the color illustrations. Yeah. And although some of the stories that I recall weren't, as Kurt said, you know, didn't have primarily to do with fairies. One of the best memories I have is this fairy story where the farmer's wife, I think it was, made some kind of deal with the devil to get this dress that was made out of dragonfly's wings. And as a child, you know, in my gingham there, and knowing what that was, the imagination took me to a place where a world that possessed dragonfly winged dresses was just this magical, gorgeous, pretend place that I kept thinking, when I get big, that's the first thing I'm going to make sure that I get is a dress made out of dragonfly's wings. I'm still looking for it, by the way. So if anybody knows anything.
Yeah. You know. And Stephen Berenson, what about your memories?
Well, the first book I ever read was East of the Sun, West of the Moon, and I remember reading it all by myself. Thank you, Miss Kabakoff. It was a chapter book with hard cover, and probably it was about 40 or 50 pages, but I remember it as though it was 500 pages, and the accomplishment of reading it. And I've actually been thinking about the actual event of reading, and I recall looking for smaller words in the larger words in order to sound out the big word.
Very good.
Every third grade teacher knows this, but I'm just remembering it now.
Oh, how great.
And then going to the dictionary to look up that word, only to discover that I couldn't read the definition, but I remember the process of reading the larger words.
And Angela, what about your memories of fairy tales?
Yeah, I come from a very large family of cousins and aunts and uncles, and my grandmother had a corner of her house with some bookshelves, and my grandparents both spoke Portuguese as their native language. So why she had all these English books there, I have no idea, but she did. And along the bottom row were these anthologies of fairy tales, essentially. And I remember being in this packed house of people running all over the place, and I was a little bit of a solitary child. And so I would go to take a break. I would sort of creep into the corner and grab a book. And I remember very vividly the pictures in these books being so extraordinary and detailed and exquisite. And I kind of remember the rest of the world blocking out and just getting sucked into those books.
It's interesting how we remember visually these books rather than
the
stories.
Right.
We were talking about this in rehearsal the other day, Bob. I mean, that's my first memory of the fairy stories were the pictures. And like the image of Hansel and Gretel pushing the witch into the oven, and then the children that she had baked into gingerbread coming back to life, and this image of joyous children. And that's really what I remember about the fairy tales are the strong images. But that's fundamental to the way that we think of fairy tales anyway, is the pictures that they evoke for us.
Well, Kurt, out of all of the thousands and thousands of fairy tales, tell us about the ones we've selected for our program today.
Well, because we wanted to reach both an adult and a child audience, we're choosing to share ones that touch on themes of love and courtship. We're going to hear two less familiar tales from the Brothers Grimm. One of them is called The Clever Farmer's Daughter, and the other is called King Thrushbeard. And then we're also going to hear The Nightingale and the Rose by Oscar Wilde. We'll hear Cinderella as told in a poem form by Anne Sexton. And we'll start with The Steadfast Tin Soldier by none other than Hans Christian Andersen.
Well, let's hear that right now. The Steadfast Tin Soldier by Hans Christian Andersen with Stephen Berenson, Angela Brazil, and Phyllis Kay.
Once upon a time there were 25 tin soldiers, all brothers, for they had all been made out of the same old tin spoon.
Hooray! Tin soldiers!
Those were the first words the soldiers heard in this world when the lid of their box was taken off. The little boy clapped his hands. The soldiers were a birthday present. They looked very smart in their red and blue uniforms, and they shouldered their guns and faced straight ahead. Each soldier was exactly like the next, except one, who had only one leg. He had been made last, and there had been not quite enough tin left.
Yet I stand just as firmly on my one leg as the others do on two.
And he is this story's hero. There were many other playthings on the table, but the one everyone noticed first was a pretty little paper castle with windows through which you could see into the rooms. In front of the castle was a tiny mirror which looked like a lake. Swans made of wax seemed to float on its surface. The effect was quite enchanting, but the prettiest thing in the whole scene was a little lady who stood in the castle's open doorway. She too was cut out of paper, but she wore a gauzy dress of the finest muslin. A narrow blue ribbon crossed her shoulders like a scarf, fastened in the middle with a glittering gold spangle nearly the size of her face. This charming creature held both of her arms outstretched, for she was a dancer. Indeed, she raised one leg so high in the air that the tin soldier couldn't see it at all. He thought that she, too, had only one leg.
She's the girl for me. But she is so grand. She lives in a castle, while I have only a box to share with my 24 brothers. Certainly no place for her. Still, I must try to make her acquaintance.
He hid himself behind a snuff box on the table. From there he had a good view of the dancer, who continued to stand on one leg without losing her balance. When night came, the other 24 tin soldiers went into their box, and the people of the house went to bed. Then the toys began to play games of their own, having parties, fighting battles. The 24 tin soldiers wanted to be out too, but they couldn't get the lid off their box. The nutcrackers played leapfrog, and the slate pencil squeaked on the slate. There was such a noise that the canary woke up and began to sing. The only two who did not move from their places were the tin soldier and the little dancer. She stood on tiptoe with both arms outstretched.
I stand steadfast on my one leg. I cannot take my eyes from her face.
Now the clock struck 12, and crack! The lid flew off the snuff box, and a little goblin popped out. It was a jack-in-the-box.
Tin soldier, keep your eyes to yourself.
I'll pretend not to hear.
All right, just you wait until tomorrow.
When it was morning, the little boy put the tin soldier on the windowsill. The goblin might have been responsible, or perhaps a draft was blowing through, but the window suddenly swung open and out fell the tin soldier, head over heels, from the third-story window. It was a dreadful fall.
I landed on my head, my leg in the air, and my bayonet wedged between two paving stones.
The nursery maid and the little boy came down at once to look for him. But though they were so near that they almost stepped on him, they did not see him. If he had called out, "Here I am," they would have found him easily.
But I do not think it proper behavior to cry out when in uniform.
Soon it began to drizzle. Then the raindrops came faster and faster, and there was a regular downpour. When it was over, two little street urchins came along.
"Just look! A tin soldier! Hey, let's send him for a sail!"
So they made a little boat out of newspaper, put the tin soldier in it, and set the boat in the fast-flowing gutter. Away it sped, and the boys ran along beside him, clapping their hands.
"What great waves there are in the gutter! And what a swift current!"
The paper boat tossed up and down and sometimes whirled around and around so fast that the tin soldier felt quite giddy.
"But I remain as steadfast as ever, not moving a muscle, looking straight ahead."
All at once the boat passed into a long tunnel under the pavement, as dark as his box had been at home.
"Where can I be going now? It must be that goblin's doing. Oh, if only the lovely lady were sitting beside me. I wouldn't mind if it were twice as dark."
Suddenly, a large water rat rushed out from its home in the tunnel.
"Have you got a passport? No getting through without a passport."
I don't say a word, though I grip my gun more tightly than ever.
The boat rushed on, and the rat chased after it. It gnashed its teeth and yelled,
"Stop him! Stop him! He hasn't paid his toll! He hasn't shown his passport!"
There was no stopping him, though, for the current became swifter and stronger as he neared the end of the tunnel.
"I see a glimpse of daylight ahead. But what is that roaring noise?"
Just imagine! At the end of the tunnel, the stream poured into a great canal. It was as dangerous for him as it would be for us to go over a giant waterfall. But he was already so near the edge that he could not stop.
No one could say that I had flinched or even blinked an eye.
The boat whirled 3-4 times round and filled to the brim, and the tin soldier stood up to his neck in water. Softer and softer grew the paper, and deeper sank the boat.
I think of the lovely little dancer. I shall never see her again.
Until finally the paper boat broke apart, the tin soldier fell out, and at that moment he was swallowed by a great fish.
Oh! How dark it is inside this fish, even darker than in the tunnel. But my courage shall not waver.
Back and forth swam the fish, then it twisted and turned wildly, and became suddenly quite still. Then
something flashed by me like a streak of lightning. I can see daylight.
All around, cheerful daylight. The fish had been caught, taken to market, sold, and brought into a kitchen, where a cook had cut it open with a great knife.
"Why, here's a little tin soldier."
He picked up the soldier between his finger and thumb and carried him in where the family could see the hero who had traveled inside a fish.
"I am not at all proud. I think nothing of it."
They stood him up on the table and, oh, what strange things do happen in this world.
I am in the same room where my adventure started. I see the same children and the same toys on the table. And there is the same grand castle with the graceful little dancer.
She was still poised on one leg with the other high in the air.
Ah, she, too, is steadfast.
The tin soldier would have liked to weep tin tears.
But that would not have been fitting for a soldier. I looked at her, and she looked at me.
But not a word passed between them. Just then, one of the little boys took up the tin soldier and threw him into the stove. The boy had no reason to do such a thing. It must have been that goblin. The tin soldier stood framed in a blaze of light. The heat was intense.
But whether it is fire or my burning passion, I do not know.
His bright colors had disappeared, but whether they had faded on his journey or through his sorrow, who can say?
I feel that I am melting, but I shall remain steadfast.
Suddenly a door opened, and a gust of air caught up the pretty little paper dancer. She flew like a sylph right into the stove, straight to the waiting tin soldier. There she burst into flames and was gone. Soon the tin soldier melted down to a lump of tin. And next morning, when the maid was raking out the ashes, she found him in the shape of a little tin heart. And what remained of the dancer? Only her gold spangle, burnt black as soot.
We've been listening to The Steadfast Tin Soldier by Hans Christian Andersen with Stephen Berenson, Angela Brazil, and Phyllis Kay. This is Trinity Rep Radio Theater. And what's the moral of that tale?
Well, you better enjoy the journey. Yeah. Because the destination might not be what you imagine.
It's so interesting, though, isn't it? When we read this, I can't help but hear echoes of sort of the modern movie fairy tales, that Toy Story kind of thing that has the same toys coming alive when people are asleep and going on adventures that take them far away and then back to the home again. And it's just so fascinating how the stories, the characters change, but they have their versions in each culture.
Yeah, and then when you get home, they pick you up and throw you in the oven.
So what is the value of being steadfast after all?
Well, it's good to be good.
Well, next we turn to the originators of so many of our familiar fairy tales, the Grimm brothers, and two of their stories offer radically different lessons for women who want to get married, King Thrushbeard and the Clever Farmer's Daughter. We'll hear these two stories as a pair. First, we'll hear King Thrushbeard by the Brothers Grimm with Stephen Berenson, Angela Brazil, and Phyllis Kay here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater.
A king had a daughter whose beauty was beyond comparison, but she was so proud and haughty that no suitor was good enough for her. Indeed, she rejected one after the other and ridiculed them as well. Finally, her father held a great feast and invited all the marriageable young men from far and wide to attend. They were all lined up according to their rank and class. The king's daughter was conducted down the line, and she found fault with each one of the suitors. One was too fat for her.
That wine barrel.
Another was too tall.
Tall and thin. He looks like a pin.
The third was too pale.
He looks like death.
The fifth was too red.
Oh, what a rooster.
The sixth did not stand straight enough.
Green wood, dried behind the stove.
There was not a single man whom she did not criticize, but she made the most fun of one good king who stood at the head of the line and had a chin that was a bit crooked.
My goodness, he's got a chin like a thrush's beak.
From then on, everyone called him Thrushbeard. When her father saw that she did nothing but ridicule people and that she scorned all the suitors who were gathered there, he was furious and swore that she would have to marry the very first beggar who came to his door. A few days later, a minstrel came and began singing beneath the windows to earn some money. When the king heard him, he said,
"Have that man come up here."
The minstrel, who was dressed in dirty, tattered clothes, entered the hall and sang in front of the king and his daughter. When he was finished, he asked the king for a modest reward.
"Your singing has pleased me so much that I shall give you my daughter for your wife."
"What?"
"I swore I'd give you to the very first beggar who came along, and I intend to keep my word."
"What?"
The priest was fetched, and she was compelled to marry the minstrel. When that was done, the king said,
"It's not fitting for you to stay in my palace any longer, now that you're a beggar woman. I want you to depart with your husband."
The minstrel took her by the hand, and she had to go with him on foot. When they came to a huge forest, she asked,
"Tell me, who might the owner of this forest be?"
The minstrel replied,
"King Thrushbeard owns the forest and all you can see. If you had taken him, it would belong to you."
"Alas, poor me, what can I do? I should have wed King Thrushbeard, if only I knew."
Soon they crossed a meadow, and she again asked,
"Tell me, who might the owner of this meadow be?"
"King Thrushbeard owns this meadow and all you can see. If you had taken him, it would belong to you."
"Alas, poor me, what can I do? I should have wed King Thrushbeard, if only I knew."
Then they came to a large city, and she asked once more,
"Tell me, who might the owner of this city be?"
"King Thrushbeard owns the city and all you can see. If you had taken him, it would belong to you."
"Alas, poor me, what can I do? I should have wed King Thrushbeard, if only I knew."
"I'm not at all pleased by this. Why are you always wishing for another husband? Do you think I'm not good enough for you?"
Finally, they came to a tiny cottage.
Oh, Lord, what a wretched tiny house. It's not even fit for a mouse.
This house is mine and yours, and we shall live here together.
The king's daughter had to stoop to get through the low doorway.
Where are the servants?
What? What servants? You must do everything yourself if you want something done. Now make a fire at once and put the water on so you can cook me my meal. I'm tired.
Of course, the king's daughter knew nothing about making a fire or cooking, and the beggar had to lend a hand himself if he wanted anything done in a tolerable fashion. After they had eaten their meager meal, they went to bed. But the next morning he got her up very early because she had to take care of the house. For a few days they lived like this and managed as best they could, but before long they had consumed all their provisions.
Wife, we can't go on this way any longer. We've used everything up and we're not earning a thing. You've got to weave baskets.
What?
He went out to cut some willows and brought them home, but the rough willows bruised her tender hands.
Ooh, ooh.
I see, that won't work. Let's try spinning. Perhaps you'll be better at that.
She sat down at the spinning wheel and tried to spin, but the hard thread soon cut her soft fingers and blood began to flow.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
See now, you're not fit for any kind of work. I made a bad bargain when I got you. But let's see how things go if I start a business with pots and earthenware. You're to sit in the marketplace and sell the wares.
The king's daughter thought.
Oh, if anyone from my father's kingdom comes to the marketplace and sees me selling wares, they'll surely make fun of me.
But there was no way to avoid it. She had to obey her husband if she did not want to die of hunger. The first time, everything went well.
People are glad to buy my wares because I am beautiful, and they pay whatever I ask. Indeed, many give their money and don't even bother to take the pots with them.
The couple lived off these earnings as long as they lasted. Then her husband bought a lot of new earthenware. She sat down with it at the corner in the marketplace and set her wares around her for sale. Suddenly, a drunken horseman galloped right over the pots, smashing them to pieces. She was paralyzed with fear and began to weep.
Oh, what's going to happen to me? What will my husband say?
She ran home and told him about the accident.
In heaven's name, who would ever sit down at a corner in the marketplace with earthenware? Oh, now stop your weeping. I see full well that you're not fit for proper work. I've been to King Thrushbeard's castle and have asked whether they could use a kitchen maid, and they've promised to take you on. In return, you'll get free meals.
So the king's daughter became a kitchen maid. She had to assist the cook and do the lowest kind of work.
I'll sew two little jars inside my pockets. That way I can carry home the leftovers so we can both have some food to live on.
One day, it happened that the king's oldest son was celebrating his wedding. The poor woman crept upstairs, stood outside the door of the large hall, and looked inside.
Look at the candles. Look at the guests. So exquisitely dressed. So splendid.
With a sad heart, the king's daughter thought about her fate and cursed her pride and arrogance for bringing about her humiliation and great poverty. The servants threw her a few morsels of the delicious dishes they were carrying in and out of the hall. She put them into her pockets to carry them home. Suddenly, the king's son entered. He was dressed in velvet and silk and had a golden chain around his neck. When he saw the beautiful woman standing in the doorway, he grabbed her by the hand and wanted to dance with her, but she refused. Indeed, she was horrified because she saw it was
King Thrushbeard,
the suitor whom she had rejected with scorn. Although she struggled, it was to no avail, for he pulled her into the hall. Then the string that held her pockets together broke. The jars fell out, and the king and his guests saw the scraps of food scattered on the floor.
Oh, no! I'm so ashamed. I wish I were 1,000 fathoms under the earth.
She ran out the door and tried to escape, but a man caught up with her on the stairs and brought her back. When she looked at him, she saw it was King Thrushbeard again, and he said to her,
"Don't be afraid. I and the minstrel who lived with you in the wretched cottage are one and the same. I disguised myself out of love for you. I was also the horseman who rode over your pots and smashed them to pieces. I did all that to humble your proud spirit and to punish you for the insolent way you behaved towards me."
I've done a great wrong and don't deserve to be your wife.
Console yourself. The bad days are over. Now we shall celebrate our wedding.
The chambermaids came and dressed her in splendid clothes, and her father came with his entire court, and they wished her happiness in her marriage with King Thrushbeard. Then the real rejoicing began, and I wish that you and I had been there too.
King Thrushbeard, and now let's hear the clever farmer's daughter.
Once upon a time, there was a poor farmer who had only a small house and a daughter, but no land. One day the daughter said,
I think we should ask the king for a little piece of farming land.
When the king learned about their poverty, he gave them a small field, which the farmer and his daughter cleared so they could sow a little wheat. When they had almost finished their work, they found a mortar of pure gold on the ground. The farmer said to his daughter,
Listen, since the king was so gracious to give us this field, we ought to give him this mortar in return.
The daughter disagreed.
Father, if we give the mortar without the pestle, then we'll have to find the pestle as well. I think we'd be better off if we kept quiet about the whole thing.
But the farmer did not listen to his daughter. He took the mortar and brought it to the king and said,
Sire, I found this golden mortar on the heath, and I humbly offer it to your majesty.
Thank you, my good man. And did you find anything else?
No.
Where's the pestle? Bring it to me.
The farmer replied that there was no pestle, but that was like talking to the wind. He was thrown into prison. The servants brought him bread and water every day, and every day they heard the farmer sighing.
Oh, if only I had listened to my daughter. If only I had listened to my daughter.
Finally, the king heard of the prisoner's strange behavior and told the servants to bring the farmer before him.
Why do you keep on with, oh, if only I had listened to my daughter? What did she tell you?
She told me not to bring you the mortar, sire, otherwise you'd think there was a pestle as well.
If you have such a clever daughter, I want to see her.
So the farmer's daughter appeared before the king.
If you are so clever, I'll give you a riddle to solve. If you solve it, I will marry you.
Immediately she replied,
I'll solve it.
All right. Come to me not dressed, not naked, not on a horse, not by carriage, not on the road, not off the road, and if you do, I'll marry you.
The farmer's daughter went home and got undressed.
Not dressed?
Next, she took a large fishnet and wrapped it completely around her.
Not naked?
Then she took a donkey and tied the fishnet to its tail. The donkey dragged her along.
Neither by horse nor by carriage.
Only her big toes touched the ground.
Neither on the road nor off it.
When she appeared before the king this way, he said,
You have solved the riddle. I will release your father from prison and take you as my wife. You will look after all the royal possessions.
The years passed happily, until one day a group of traveling farmers stopped in front of the castle to pass the night. During the night, one of the farmer's horses gave birth to a foal. The foal left its mother and lay down between two oxen, which were hitched to another farmer's wagon. Now the farmer with the oxen wanted to keep the foal. He claimed that the oxen had given birth to it. The horse farmer said,
No, my mare delivered that foal and it's mine.
The quarrel was taken before the king, who declared,
Wherever the foal has laid itself down, there it shall stay.
So the farmer with the oxen got the foal, even though it did not belong to him. The other farmer went away weeping.
I've heard that the queen is compassionate and came from a farmer's family. I'll go to her and ask if she can help me get my foal back.
Yes, I can, but you must promise not to tell that I've helped you. Now, here's what you have to do. Early tomorrow, before the king sets out, place yourself in the middle of the road. Bring a large fish net with you and pretend to fish with it. Keep fishing and shaking the net out as though it were full.
She also told him what to answer the king when he questioned him. The next day, the farmer got up early and went fishing on dry land. Before long, the king rode by and saw him.
What are you doing, you foolish man?
I'm fishing. If two oxen can give birth to a foal, then I can manage to catch a fish on dry land.
You didn't think of that answer yourself. Who helped you?
At first, the farmer refused to tell, but the king was persuasive.
Tell me now.
Oh, it was your clever queen, your majesty. She helped me in her kindness.
The king returned to the palace and said to his wife,
Why did you trick me? I no longer want you for my wife. Your time is up. Go back to the farmhouse where you belong.
Very well, dear husband. Your wish is my command. But I beg you, let me take with me the dearest and best thing I can think of as a parting gift.
The king agreed. They embraced and drank to their parting. But she gave the king a strong sleeping potion, and he fell into a deep sleep. The queen wrapped the sleeping king in a fine linen sheet and had two trusted servants carry him outside to a carriage. She took her husband to her father's house and put him to bed. He slept a whole day and night, and when he woke up, he cried,
What? Where am I?
Dear king, you told me I could take the dearest and best thing I know from the castle, and I took you. You are the dearest and best thing I know.
Dear wife, you shall be mine and I shall be yours forever.
Then he took her back to the castle and married her again. And I'm sure that they're still living together, even today.
That was The Clever Farmer's Daughter and King Thrushbeard, both featuring Stephen Berenson, Angela Brazil, Kurt Columbus, and Phyllis Kaye, here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater, works of the Brothers Grimm. And two clever tricksters we have here. We have King Thrushbeard, who does his bit of trickery, and The Clever Farmer's Daughter as well.
It's so interesting, Bob. You know, we've been talking about this. A lot of these fairy tales are based around a negotiation of marriage contracts. And they don't really have anything to do with romance. We think of them as being romantic, and perhaps we put that on them. But really, they're contractual arrangements. I mean, you know, the clever farmer's daughter figures out how to get control of all of the possessions in the castle, right? And the same with King Thrushbeard. What he does is take away the status of the king's daughter, and then their relationship comes together. It's a negotiation of relationship through property, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. I find that a little bit odd.
No, I actually see it a little differently. I see
go,
it
Phyllis,
as being,
go.
Well, it's a, you know, I mean, that's very nicely put, but I mean, especially the King Thrushbeard, it seems to be about subjugation to me. I mean, they talk about, you know, the similarities between especially King Thrushbeard and Taming of the Shrew
right.
are so clear cut where, you know, they talk about it. They make it sound like a nice thing. What does he say?
Well, he says, I did all of this to humble your proud spirit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, any questions? Yeah.
Good night.
But then she herself cursed her pride and arrogance for bringing her humiliation and poverty.
Well, what would you do if you had a room full of people laughing at you?
But the clever farmer's daughter is interesting because she's sort of the opposite. She's the empowered feminine, if you will. And it's fascinating that you have both in these two tales.
Yeah, and I actually like the order of those two because for me, the first one, King Thrushbeard, is almost more of sort of the classic fairy tale in that it's got all the trappings. It's got kings and princes and a big gathering and a
right.
party and then, you know, the humble cottage and the, you know, the travel. And the second one is almost, even in sentence structure, it's more modern and contemporary. Mm. And thankfully, she wins, I believe, in the end. I'm not sure King Thrushbeard's wife wins in the
both
end.
Both stories deal with reversal
yes.
and role
true.
Reversal.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
And finding ways to get two people on the same level with the same status so that they can live happily ever after.
And that, Stephen, is the thing that really is the hallmark of a great fairy tale, is that reversal, that where we think we're going is where we don't end up at the end. And that's what's fascinating about all these stories is they take us on a journey, but then we end up in some place we didn't expect.
Well, now let's hear from one of our old favorites, Oscar Wilde.
Yes.
Yes, last season we enjoyed reading his fairy tale, The Happy Prince, and today we have The Nightingale and the Rose. The Nightingale and the Rose by Oscar Wilde with Stephen Berenson, Angela Brazil, Kurt Columbus, and Phyllis Kaye.
A young student sat and sighed.
She said that she would dance with me if I brought her red roses. but in all my garden there is no red rose. Ah, on what little things does happiness depend? I have read all that the wise men have written, and all the secrets of philosophy are mine, yet for want of a red rose is my life made wretched.
From her nest in the oak tree the nightingale heard him. She looked out through the leaves and wondered,
Is this a true lover at last? Night after night have I sung of him, though I knew him not, and now I see him. His lips are red as the rose of his desire, but passion has made his face like pale ivory, and sorrow has set her seal upon his brow.
The prince gives a ball tomorrow night, and my love will be of the company. If I bring her a red rose, she will dance with me till dawn. If I bring her a red rose, I shall hold her in my arms, and she will lean her head upon my shoulder, and her hand will be clasped in mine. But there is no red rose in my garden, so she will pass me by, and my heart will break.
Here indeed is the true lover. What I sing of, he suffers. What is joy to him is pain. Surely love is a wonderful thing. It is more precious than emeralds, and dearer than fine opals.
She will dance so lightly that her feet will not touch the floor. But with me she will not dance, for I have no red rose to give her.
The student flung himself down on the grass, buried his face in his hands, and wept. The nightingale understood the secret of the student's sorrow. She sat silent in the oak tree, and thought about the mystery of love. Beneath the student's window, she saw a rose tree without any blossoms.
Give me a red rose, and I will sing you my sweetest song.
But the rose tree shook its head and said, My roses are red, but the winter has chilled my veins. The frost has nipped my buds, and I shall have no roses at all this year.
One red rose is all I want, only one red rose. Is there no way by which I can get it?
There is a way, but it is so terrible that I dare not tell it to you.
Tell it to me. I am not afraid.
If you want a red rose, you must build it out of music by moonlight, and stain it with your own heart's blood. You must sing to me with your breast against a thorn. All night long you must sing to me, and the thorn must pierce your heart, and your life-blood must flow into my veins and become mine.
Death is a great price to pay for a red rose, and life is very dear to all. Yet love is better than life. And what is the heart of a bird compared to the heart of a man?
So she spread her brown wings for flight, soared into the air, and landed in the grass, where the student was still lying. The tears were not yet dry in his beautiful eyes.
Be happy, be happy. You shall have your red rose. I will build it out of music by moonlight, and stain it with my own heart's blood. All that I ask of you in return is that you will be a true lover, for love is wiser than philosophy.
The student looked up and listened, but he could not understand what the nightingale was saying to him, for he only knew the things that are written down in books. But the oak tree understood and felt sad, for he was very fond of the little bird who had built her nest in his branches. He whispered,
Sing me one last song. I shall feel very lonely when you are gone.
So the nightingale sang to the oak tree, and her voice was like water bubbling from a silver jar. When she had finished her song, the student got up and walked away.
She has form that cannot be denied to her, but has she got feeling? I'm afraid not. In fact, she is like most artists. She is all style without any sincerity. She would not sacrifice herself for others. She thinks merely of music, and everybody knows that the arts are selfish. Still, it must be admitted that she has some beautiful notes in her voice. What a pity it is that they do not mean anything or do any practical good.
And he went into his room and lay down on his little pallet bed and began to think of his love. And after a time he fell asleep. And when the moon shone in the heavens, the nightingale flew to the rose tree and set her breast against the thorn. All night long she sang with her breast against the thorn, and the cold crystal moon leaned down and listened. All night long she sang, and the thorn went deeper and deeper into her breast. She sang first of the birth of love in the heart of a boy and a girl, and on the topmost spray of the rose tree there blossomed a marvelous rose, petal following petal, as song followed song. The nightingale pressed closer against the thorn, and louder grew her song, for she sang of the birth of passion in the soul of a man and a maid. And a delicate flush of pink came into the leaves of the rose, like the flush in the face of the bridegroom when he kisses the lips of the bride. But the thorn had not yet reached her heart, so the rose's heart remained white. The nightingale pressed closer, the thorn touched her heart, and a fierce pang of pain shot through her. Wilder and wilder grew her song, for she sang of the love that is perfected by death, of the love that dies not in the tomb. And the marvelous rose became crimson, like the rose of the eastern sky. But the nightingale's voice grew fainter, until she gave one last burst of music. The white moon heard it, and she forgot the dawn, and lingered on in the sky. The red rose heard it, and trembled all over with ecstasy, and opened its petals to the cold morning air. The oak tree cried,
"Look, look, the rose is finished now."
But the nightingale made no answer, for she was lying dead in the long grass with the thorn in her heart. At noon the student opened his window and looked out.
"Why, what a wonderful piece of luck! Here is a red rose. I have never seen any rose like it in all my life. It is so beautiful that I am sure it has a long Latin name."
And he leaned down and plucked it. Then he put on his hat and ran to his lady love with the rose in his hand. She was sitting in her doorway winding blue silk on a reel with her little dog at her feet.
"You said that you would dance with me if I brought you a red rose. Here is the reddest rose in all the world. You will wear it tonight next to your heart, and as we dance together it will tell you how I love you."
But the girl frowned and said,
"I'm afraid it will not go with my dress. And besides, the chamberlain's nephew has sent me some real jewels, and everybody knows that jewels cost far more than flowers."
"Well, upon my word, you are very ungrateful."
"Ungrateful? I tell you what, you are very rude. And after all, who are you? Only a student? Why, I don't believe you've even got silver buckles to your shoes, as the chamberlain's nephew has."
The girl got up from her chair and went into the house. The student threw the rose into the street, where it fell into the gutter and a cartwheel went over it.
"What a silly thing love is. It is not half as useful as logic, for it does not prove anything, and it is always telling one of things that are not going to happen and making one believe things that are not true. In fact, it is quite impractical. And as in this age to be practical is everything, I shall go back to philosophy and study metaphysics."
So he returned to his room and pulled out a great dusty book and began to read.
The Nightingale and the Rose by Oscar Wilde, with Stephen Berenson, Angela Brazil, Kurt Columbus, and Phyllis Kay on the Trinity Rep Radio Theater. Oh,
I love that. I mean, this is why the Oscar Wilde stories keep coming back for us, is that there's such a poetry to them and a beauty that is really unparalleled in a lot of the writing that we find, particularly in these construction of these fairy tales. I mean, it's just exquisite.
The image of, you know, what he describes, the sacrifice that the bird makes, you know, to create this idealized tribute
single
to
road
love.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then
Rose, yeah.
I have that image of the creation and the pain that's involved in that, and then the image of the rose lying in the gutter,
yeah,
with the wheel going over it is just almost more than I can stand.
Yeah.
It's just so beautiful.
But that's what Wilde's doing in this story, isn't he? He's taking the form that we know and subverting it.
It's the combination of pathos and cynicism.
What, Stephen? That's really smart.
It's very touching. You feel for the bird. You feel for the oak tree.
Uh-huh.
And for a long time, you feel for the student, and then you realize that he has no feelings at all. He, like the rose at the end, is garbage.
Yeah. Well, and as is his lady love, too. That's
mm-hmm,
sort of
right.
Interesting, the way that the love gets turned on its head as well, right?
Mm. Well, that's the romantic love clashing with the reality of
Yeah, I mean, if we think about it historically, you know, Wilde is writing in the 19th century, and so there's a different idea about love and marriage. It's not the marriage contract anymore. Now it's love as romance, and it's this poetical thing. So.
But the romance also involves the gifts we give people whom, you know, who we love are not necessarily always the gifts they want to receive.
Right.
So she has a totally different idea about what a tribute is from what he has imagined.
Right.
Or sometimes we think we want something very badly, like the student wants the red rose, and it's not what we want at all.
Mm-hmm. And what about the nightingale, the role the bird plays?
You know, I think when you begin reading this story, or listening to the story, maybe, I think you think that the student is going to be the protagonist, and then it's actually a lovely surprise and discovery that the nightingale actually is. You know, we were talking about this thing of when children listen to or read fairy tales, they immediately identify with the protagonist without question, without thought. And here I find that to be a very interesting switch over, you know, and then the protagonist dies, which is incredibly unexpected and very moving.
Is true love something that is real or imagined or aspired to?
It's real. It's real.
It is real. It is real. It is real. And the bird experiences love.
Bob, it's
she
so
knows
right,
of the
right, right.
I, you know, I was thinking about this through the whole story. You can't ask that of a room of actors because we all believe in true love. That is one of the motivating forces of what we do on stage, is to show that sort of thing exists. But it's
despite evidence to the contrary.
No, evidence there is evidence. The bird experiences true love,
and
totally
ends up,
selfless
and
love.
Ends up dead.
Yeah. What's your point?
After that great sentence.
I mean, we can't let it pass without remarking on this little passage that Oscar Wilde puts in, everybody knows that the arts are selfish.
Right. Mm.
Oh.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic.
It turns for me with the student there. I can't be with them anymore.
Well, fine. Let's move on to our final story. Kurt, tell us about this.
Well, we wanted to add something that had a little bit of a 20th century edge to it. So we went to the writing of Anne Sexton, who's one of the great New England poets of the 20th century. And it turns out that she has a Cinderella tale. So how could we not end with reading Cinderella? By Anne Sexton.
Cinderella by Anne Sexton, with Stephen Berenson, Angela Brazil, Kurt Columbus, and Phyllis Kay on Trinity Rep Radio Theater.
You always read about it. The plumber with the 12 children who wins the Irish sweepstakes. From toilets to riches. That story.
Or the nursemaid, some luscious sweet from Denmark who captures the oldest son's heart. From diapers to Dior. That story.
Or a milkman who serves the wealthy. Eggs, cream, butter, yogurt, milk. The white truck like an ambulance, who goes into real estate and makes a pile. From homogenized to martinis at lunch.
Or the charwoman who is on the bus when it cracks up and collects enough from the insurance. From mops to Bonwit teller. That story. Once, the wife of a rich man was on her deathbed, and she said to her daughter, Cinderella, be devout, be good, then I will smile down from heaven in the seam of a cloud. The man took another wife, who had two daughters, pretty enough, but with hearts like blackjacks. Cinderella was their maid. She slept on the sooty hearth each night and walked around looking like Al Jolson. Her father brought presents home from town, jewels and gowns for the other women, but the twig of a tree for Cinderella. She planted that twig on her mother's grave, and it grew to a tree where a white dove sat. Whenever she wished for anything, the dove would drop it like an egg upon the ground. The bird is important, my dears, so heed him. Next came the ball, as you all know. It was a marriage market. The prince was looking for a wife. All but Cinderella were preparing and gussying up for the event. Cinderella begged to go, too. Her stepmother threw a dish of lentils into the cinders and said, "Pick them up in an hour and you shall go." The white dove brought all his friends. All the warm wings of the fatherland came and picked up the lentils in a jiffy.
No, Cinderella, said the stepmother. You have no clothes and cannot dance. That's the way with stepmothers. Cinderella went to the tree at the grave and cried forth like a gospel singer, Mama, Mama, my turtle dove, send me to the prince's ball. The bird dropped down a golden dress and delicate little slippers. Rather a large package for a simple bird. So she went, which is no surprise. Her stepmother and sisters didn't recognize her without her cinder face, and the prince took her hand on the spot and danced with no other the whole day. As nightfall came, she thought she'd better get home. The prince walked her home, and she disappeared into the pigeon house, and although the prince took an axe and broke it open, she was gone. Back to her cinders. These events repeated themselves for 3 days. However, on the third day, the prince covered the palace steps with cobbler's wax, and Cinderella's gold shoe stuck upon it. Now he would find whom the shoe fit, and find his strange dancing girl for keeps. He went to their house, and the two sisters were delighted because they had lovely feet. The eldest went into a room to try the slipper on, but her big toe got in the way, so she simply sliced it off and put on the slipper. The prince rode away with her until the white dove told him to look at the blood pouring forth. That is the way with amputations. They just don't heal up like a wish. The other sister cut off her heel, but the blood told as blood will. The prince was getting tired. He began to feel like a shoe salesman, but he gave it one last try. This time, Cinderella fit into the shoe like a love letter into its envelope. At the wedding ceremony, the two sisters came to curry favor, and the white dove pecked their eyes out. Two hollow spots were left, like soup spoons. Cinderella and the prince lived, they say, happily ever after, like two dolls in a museum case, never bothered by diapers or dust, never arguing over the timing of an egg, never telling the same story twice, never getting a middle-aged spread, their darling smiles pasted on for eternity. Regular Bobbsey twins. That story.
Cinderella by Anne Sexton, with Angela Brazil, Stephen Berenson, Kurt Columbus, and Phyllis Kay here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater. Wow, that's quite an interesting take on an old fairy tale, and it really helps to know the story of Cinderella, of course, when you hear that. It reminds me when we were talking about fairy tales as being oral histories, mm-hmm. passing down from one person to another, and, hey, you've heard that story. Well, how about this story?
Right. Yeah, it's not the story, it's the way in which it's told that counts in this one, which brings us back, as you're suggesting, Bob, to this notion that we pass these along. And I loved listening to Ange read that because I just think of you reading a story to your son, and I know, and not that one, darling, but I mean the image of the way in which it's told and how it then enters the child and then gets passed along is just fascinating. I couldn't help that watching you read it.
Well, to me, it makes you pay attention because you're listening to the story, but she'll say things like, she slept on the city hearth each night, and then she says, and walked around looking like Al Jolson.
Right, wait a minute,
what story am I listening? And there are those lines that she throws in after the lines you're used to hearing about, which is a way of saying, hey, listen to this version of the story.
Well, what's great is the first time I heard it, I was reminded of the idea that every time you hear a story, before you put it away into your memory, you change it a little bit. It's filtered through your own experience. So that's so clearly apparent in her telling of this story, where it's just tweaked enough so that it's startling in a way where you say, I can see where she's going with this.
Right.
And to the point where, you know, the images at the end of just these staring, smiling,
like Barbie doll. People on the cake top. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. In a museum exactly case. So.
Well, and we talked about this a lot. The notion of happily ever after, and you know, that bill of goods that you're sold when you're a child, that you're going to find some kind of happily ever after situation, and that the story both plays into that and subverts it.
Well, what I think is so great about it is actually this time when I listened to it, I was kind of cheered up by the idea that, yeah, I have to deal with listening to that story again, and I have to deal with middle-aged spread, and I'm doing pretty well with all those things. I'm not in a museum case somewhere. Lucky them.
So it's like the voice of experience or wisdom saying to you, yes, we all aspire to these wonderful things, but hey, in reality, this is what we live, and this is our experience.
And doing a pretty good job with it.
Yeah, yeah. And she uses the poetic image as a way to play into what we expect from the fairy tale and then subvert it at the same time. I love the stepsisters getting their eyes pecked out at the end, which and you know, and the amputations, those are all part of the traditional version of Cinderella. But what she leaves us with is the eyes like hollowed soup spoons. I mean, that sticks in you, you know. Yeah. The way that those images in the book stick in you. Again, we're back to the notion that fairy tales need to be very visual in order to draw us in.
And the cynicism, again, is what changes. Well, it does. You know, it becomes, it goes from images to a point of view about the images and the brutality of them. Where for a child, that's not frightening.
Right, no. That's true.
You mean about the sisters trying on the shoes and instead of them being a little tight, they cut off their toes.
I remember when I read, I mean, I don't remember, you know, like, but I remember that I wasn't troubled by it. I just thought, oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, cutting off
very
your toe.
Very true, yeah. I mean, kids do that. Kids are able to immediately identify with almost the big feelings in a story because, you know, they're these little creatures, especially six and under, who feel these huge feelings themselves and don't quite know what to do with them. So they get it. They get that anger and rage.
And they don't want to connect.
They get her sorrow and they get, you know.
Wicked stepsister who wants to. Wicked.
Right, exactly.
Step. Yeah, cut off her foot. Yeah. Step.
Yeah. And again, you know, as adults, we see these images of violence and hear them with very different ears and eyes than a child does who doesn't have the benefit of all the media exposure that we've had at the time in our lives that we are, you know. They're hearing it with their fresh ears, and they're hearing good and evil, and that's something that they inherently know.
And we're hearing these fairy tales retold, which is, she does a pretty spectacular job.
Oh, she's got a whole volume of these.
Cinderella by Anne Sexton. Well, thank you all. You have been listening to Trinity Rep Radio Theater, featuring The Steadfast Tin Soldier by Hans Christian Andersen, The Grimm Brothers, King Thrushbeard and the Clever Farmer's Daughter, The Nightingale and the Rose by Oscar Wilde, and Anne Sexton's Cinderella. Cinderella is recorded by permission of SOL Sterling Lord Literistic. Copyright by Anne Sexton. Today's program featured Stephen Berenson, Angela Brazil, and Phyllis Kay, directed by Janice Duclos. Trinity Rep Radio Theater is a production of WRNI and Trinity Repertory Company. Janice Duclos and Emily Atkinson, producers. Kurt Columbus, executive producer. Joe O'Connor, general manager. Trinity Rep Radio Theater is made possible in part by generous support from the Rhode Island Foundation, a charitable community trust serving the people of Rhode Island. Thank you for joining us, and please tune in again next month for Trinity Rep Radio Theater. I'm Bob Seale.